It is my great pleasure, I being Paula Gordon, to be with Millie Monks. I think in America particularly, maybe more so than most any place, because we're so committed to our stuff, right, that we just don't want to talk about death, we don't want to think about death. There is a great aversion, active aversion, to the subject that is death. And we might be denying ourselves some very good news, as your
friend said.
Indeed. Don't you think it quite remarkable, when everything that lives is going to die, that we ignore it, that we push it away, that we don't think of death as part of life?
Yeah.
Don't we deny ourselves something by virtue of that?
I think, in a sense, I was lucky in my book that I felt that my mother, that was my mother's message. And that was really what started me off being interested in it.
Because really?
I don't think most people certainly are.
No, indeed.
And,
that,
and then, of course, I did get to say one sentence to the Maharishi. My good husband got the other half an hour, they couldn't stop talking. Maharishi Mahesh Yoga, and I asked him. I said, "Is meditating a small death?" And he was quiet for a minute, and he said, "Yes."
Meditation has been very important to you. Is it since the cancer?
Probably started then.
And you chose the transcendental meditation, the TM
approach.
Did you happen into that? Were you? There are many, many, many paths.
There are. Yes, I did. There was a place next door, and I ended up, I had 2 years of chemo when I had cancer, pretty regularly, and at one point they told me I could not continue because my white blood count was too low. And I said, "Well, give me 2 weeks and let me see what I can do." So I just meditated very, very carefully. And I was what they call a siddha by then, which is the levitating sutras. And it was so happy. I would sit in the bed and I'd go up and down. I mean, this is the middle of thinking, you know, maybe I'm not going to make this. I went back and my white blood count was fine. But now they're discovering all sorts of the Buddhists, and they're meditating, and the happiness that comes with meditating for the Buddhists, and so they're opening up all that.
Now, I think it is very funny to be sitting in Maine, that very proper state, in this very proper part of the country, New Englanders who don't do a lot on the subject of happiness as a culture.
That's true.
Isn't there a seeking in that alone, that to be pursuing happiness when you could be, well, let's see, what do the Puritans pursue?
not happiness.
No. And in a way, it seems that that's part of our loss in not thinking about death, because it doesn't give us the room to say, let us rejoice in the moment.
Yes, and those that do meditate tremendously long hours and for many, many years are very happy.
I remember my mother was quite puritanical in her own way, and I remember once saying to her something that a major turn in my life, that I thought that I could pursue happiness, and she looked at me and said, happiness is not the point of life.
Oh, well.
And then I had a good counselor who said happiness was worth pursuing.
And I think that's one of the Maharishi's great gifts that he left us with, is happiness. Well, they claim to be in a state of bliss. I'm very envious, but the long-term meditators.
I think that your coping with mental illness has been a meditation. I partly think about it because you had to do it in private, almost secret, and mental health, wellness, illness is such a foreign country to us.
Yes, it's so sad.
Is this something that has been part of your life always?
Mental illness?
Yeah.
Well, I think my mother wasn't well. And I think the particular illness in the family, I'm beginning to think maybe is inherited. I mean, I think the borderline personality is inherited. actually, just recently, in the last maybe 6 months, they've discovered where it lies in the brain. And it lies in the brain where anger is held. I can't remember what part of the brain.
That would be the limbic, probably.
Limbic brain. Mm. And that's very typical of borderline personalities is the rage. Huge rage that they can't control.
That they can't control.
They can't control it. And that they found that means that in 3 or 4 years, maybe they'll find something that they can, some way to help them.
Is meditation one of the ways that people are seeking to address this particular?
No.
No.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't think that people who have a serious mental illness find it easy to meditate.
Yeah. You talk about four generations within your family, which takes us back to your grandmother or great-grandmother.
Right.
So that there's a thread that runs through, but it doesn't touch everyone. And at least in your stories, you talk only about the women in the family.
Right.
Is that just lucky?
Lucky?
Yeah, that the men don't seem... they get off lighter on at least...
No.
At least that...
No.
Well, there are things that are inherited along the gender lines.
Yeah.
So when did you begin thinking in terms of mental illness and mental wellness, health and disease?
For myself,
yes.
You mean?
Uh-huh.
That's been fairly recent, actually. About 4 or 5 years ago, I could barely stand up.
Mm.
I went into Portland and fell down on the brick and was unconscious for 4 hours.
You just fell down?
Well, what had happened, they said at the Mayo Clinic it was stress and trauma, and that made me very dizzy, and it made my my legs would give out very quickly. I did a lot of work with a Jungian analyst about that. It's been wonderful. And I'm really almost over it. I think one of the things, it sounds very strange, is that one of the attributes of a borderline personality is they're very psychic, and so am I. I used to be very psychic, and I've kind of lost it. But they can invade you. And there is a book called Mount Misery that talks about this, about a young psychiatrist at the McLean's Hospital and how these doctors wouldn't take borderline patients because they began to feel they looked like them or they should go jump out of a car or they did something they didn't feel it belonged to them. And when I learned how to stop that, and I think that was, and doing a lot of meditating, I think I've sort of moved on.
It sounds like developing a psychological muscle almost.
Yes, thank you.
Is that right?
Yeah. It's a switch in the brain somehow.
When you talk about going to the Mayo Clinic and having them talk about stress, how do you get from stress and trauma, and it's important to talk about that trauma since you're willing to do so, to falling down? What is it they say happens physically? Because it's what this says to me is we are so much, this mind and body is all it together, that there's not a duality here.
Yes.
Is that some of what you're saying?
Well, I think they're learning a lot more about trauma now with the soldiers coming back from the war. So I think it's a fairly new thing, and the Mayo Clinic really wasn't much help. I think they're much more into it now than they were 5 years ago.
What kind of trauma? I mean, when you say trauma, what is in you, if to the extent you're willing to talk about it, what is the trauma of which you speak?
Well, I think first growing up and locking myself in my room every night and not being fed, that's pretty traumatic.
So you mean literally?
Literally. And being so fearful. You know,
fearful of?
Well, I was going to find somebody sitting behind a curtain, my mother, or...
And you had reason to fear that.
I had reason to fear that in the dark, or... it was a pretty terrible atmosphere to grow up in.
And your mother was violent?
No, I wouldn't... Well, she got very angry. She could get very angry, but...
This isn't just mom getting mad and then go on to the next subject angry.
No, this is crawling on the floor angry.
Rage.
Really angry. Rage.
crawling on the floor.
Well, she had done that once.
Yeah.
Screaming at my sister, and my sister left and just never went back.
And you were...
She's not with us now, so I don't mind saying
yeah,
that. But,
yeah. And you were too young, too frightened, too attached?
Well, I had
attached.
No place to go. It was the war. My father was in New Guinea with a nurse's station, and my brother had gone, and there was nobody.
You wouldn't think that a youngster who is born into one of the most wealthy places in the planet.
I know.
No place to go?
No place to go. Well, I didn't know any place to go anyway. I mean, and then she would refuse to let my friend see me, and so I got kind of isolated. But that was before boarding school. But that was trauma. That will count as trauma.
Your father is another story that has all sorts of ramifications in your life as well.
Yeah.
Especially as I read the stories in Stories from
right.
Three Islands, I was very taken that there was never a whine in this, and there was never a poor little rich girl element in this, for which I compliment you.
No compliment. You don't feel very rich when you're living in a room all by yourself most of the time, and nobody's around to talk to. And so riches, I think the statement I said in the book is, I began to see people as neither rich nor poor, but either they were kind, or they were the unkind, or they were thoughtful, or they were careless. So I didn't see people, because I had no idea about money. I had my subway money to go to the school, because we had a secretary that came in every so often. But
And the way you fed yourself included those subway
yes,
stations.
Yes.
It's remarkable. It's like a street urchin story.
Yeah, it was a bit.
How did you get food? I mean, at some point you have to... How did you sustain life?
Well, I had a lunch at school. And sometimes I went to visit friends and things. But I had money to get at the drugstore. I had orange fizzes, which were delicious. And candy bars, which were wonderful.
Isn't there a malnourished function coming to play
well, I
here?
I had a good meal at school, I guess. I don't know.
We're going to come back with Millie Monks in just a moment. Be with us when we return. Mm-hmm.